I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. If you spend any time in the city, you're going to encounter homeless people panhandling, sleeping on the street, living in makeshift shelters, or even communities. Most of us just pass them by. My guest, Philippe Bourgois, got to know a community of homeless heroin and crack addicts in San Francisco. For more than a decade, he and photographer Jeff Schonberg spent time with them, even lived with them, to try to understand their world. The daily hunt for drugs, the violence, the betrayals, the moments of connection and intimacy, the attempts to get clean. Those stories, along with photos and field notes, are in a new book called Righteous Dope Fiend. Philippe Bourgois is the Richard Perry University Professor of Anthropology and Family and Community Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you on the show. Good morning.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Let me start with the title of your book, and I just have been turning it over and over in my head, Righteous Dope Fiend. Where does that come from?
You know, it's a term that they use on the street. It means that you're dedicated to using heroin above all things. It's actually a term of ambivalent pride. It's an admission of being an addict and of not apologizing for being an addict. But more importantly, it's that you do addiction in an effective way. You've subordinated your family, you've subordinated your relationships, you've subordinated your body to using heroin.
Talk a bit, if you would, about this particular community that you spent time with, and this was in San Francisco, and it was a while ago. You were there for more than, or you were involved for more than 10 years, Edgewater Woods.
Yeah, I stayed with them for 12 years, actually. I started the project in November 1994, and it was 6 blocks away from my house at the base of a set of intersecting freeways, sort of a no man's land of empty warehouses. It was the old industrial neighborhood of San Francisco. So it's the kind of place where the homeless are sort of tolerated. People don't immediately call the police on them. And there's also lots of things they can scavenge for. They can recycle from the abandoned warehouses. There's lots of old aluminum and stuff like that that they rip off the abandoned buildings. They panhandle and commit petty crimes, basically.
And would you say this is a community in the way that we understand
absolutely.
A community?
No, this is that's the first thing that I discovered. Basically, you know, in order to go anywhere from my house, I had to pass this one corner where they assembled, where you would see them every day, half a dozen of them. And I could see, I'd worked before with crack users and crack sellers in New York, doing a book called In Search of Respect, Selling Crack in El Barrio. And so I recognized that these were drug users, and they looked to me like heroin users. They weren't as hyped up as crack users. And they were that demographic, that over 40 demographic, that population group that got addicted in the 70s and was swept off its feet and has remained addicted for all those years, or going in and out of addiction, often going into treatment for a few years and then falling back into addiction. So basically, I just... I said, I'm tired of walking by these guys. Who are they? You know, occasionally I would give them a quarter or a dollar or whatever, and I never knew, you know, is this helping them? What is it doing? How do they survive? And I kept seeing the same faces. So I said, well, time to look into this. And literally all it took was stepping 3 steps off the sidewalk into the bushes and into one of the encampments, and they greeted me with open arms. I said, I'm a professor. I'm interested in your lives. I explained that I'd done a book before on crack dealers, and now I was interested in the experience of addiction. And they literally, the guy wiped off, he had a milk crate with, you know, it had been raining, so it was wet, and he wipes off this the water from the milk crate and says, sit down, professor.
Wow. What did this encampment look like when you went in there?
You know, the first thing that hits you is the smell when you're not used to it. It's there's no running water, obviously, and there's no garbage facilities and so forth. So it stinks, and it's sopping wet. And then you see, you know, how they're trying to keep the rain out. So it's
with tents.
This was a set of, they were using blue tarps in this setting. Basically, it was a shanty shack covered with blue tarps in here. And there were 4 guys living there.
And do you ever get used to that smell?
You know, you do.
Spent,
believe
as you
it or
said,
not,
a decade.
You,
or
believe it
years.
Or not, you actually do. I mean, it's really hard at first, and especially you're looking around because you don't want to step in the wrong thing, so to speak, because there's no toilet facilities, and you know, all of a sudden, it gets normalized. After several weeks of going down and hanging out in these scenes, you stop noticing it. Now, my co-author of this book, Jeff Schomburg, he's lucky. He has a bad sense of smell, so it just didn't bother him. And I think that's why he did the fieldwork so beautifully and why he had so much patience to spend so much time and take photographs so intimately.
And these are black and white photographs and just graphic and chilling and moving in the way that I think these kinds of photographs can be. This is a community built around getting drugs, right? Getting crack cocaine, getting heroin.
Yeah, we call it a community of addicted bodies. Basically, it's people who have basically dedicated their lives to drugs and can't find a place in society where they're allowed to do that or where they're allowed to do that in a non-destructive way. Essentially, they're fleeing the police. That's why they're living in these filthy settings. And they're not accessing services. They're running away from authority, and they've basically had negative experiences all through their life every time they've come into contact with institutions.
How do they get money?
The biggest source of money is panhandling. After that, they do a lot of day labor. The local businesses on the surrounding boulevards in this industrial district will hire someone to, you know, unload a beer truck or shovel sandbags. There was a moving company that would pick them up for day jobs. But it's very insecure work. It's for 1-2 days. And they're very cheap. And they're always there. They're always standing on the corner. So there's a set of employers that will pick them up.
And addicts of this level can work?
Yeah. They can work when they've taken their heroin and when they're not smoking crack. Crack disorganizes them. It tends to hype them up and get them paranoid and make them confused in some sense. But if they take basically a small amount of heroin to hold off their withdrawal symptoms, they actually get calm, believe it or not. Heroin is a sedative. So when someone is pretty anxious, when someone is pretty, is unstable, when someone has had a traumatic life, it actually tends to calm them down. And if they take a lot, they just nod out and drool and they're useless, basically. But if they take a little bit, they then can become functional.
You know, I want to play just an excerpt of a clip, and this is part of the audio of a video recording that you and Jeff Schomburg made. This is an early morning injection session of three homeless addicts. And I guess the most prominent voice we hear is someone that you call Felix. Anything you want to say before we listen to this?
Yeah, this was early in our project. It was during the first year. And so I'm funded by the National Institutes of Health. So I had been steering conversations to the risk of HIV and what kinds of filthy injection practices they were doing to make sure that they knew what they were doing and the risks they were taking, and also to try to figure out, do they understand, biological vectors of infectious disease infection? And so so you'll hear that. He puts things in the context of medicine. But what you'll hear also is that sense of community. It's hard at first to pick up on it, but basically you see them lending each other small amounts of money and drugs constantly. And that's how they survive, basically. They're always short of money. But by giving out a little bit, so what's happened here is Felix he's treated one of his companions to a little bit of drugs, and then that companion is going to, he has a job later on that day in moving, with the moving van. So he'll buy the next set of drugs and treat Felix. And that's how they maintain these relationships of sort of help and distrust. So you hear both the nervousness about it and then the reassurance, and they're constantly testing one another.
Let's listen, and this is a clip. Let's listen.
When are you going to pay me?
When I get the money.
Today? After you work today?
That's possible.
We'll buy a bag and you can give me back dope, okay?
Yeah.
I'll take half of the bag.
That sounds like good.
That'll be fine. I'm cooking the dope now, guys. This is my medicine. I have to have it every morning. Otherwise, I don't function.
We all
cannot.
We can't work. We can't do nothing.
Yeah. It's like medicine. Exactly like medicine.
It is medicine.
And that's Felix saying this dope is like medicine. I need it every morning.
Yeah, that's the nature of opiate addiction. It's basically, once you're addicted to heroin, none of the cells in your body can function. They need the opiate proteins. So just, you know, your skin cells start sweating, start itching, your mucous membranes are dripping, you lose control of your bowels, you get aches and pains all through your body, and it basically, you become completely dysfunctional in withdrawal symptoms.
And I wonder, just as an outsider, an anthropologist watching these drug addicts shooting up, just what that was, the effect that it had on you to stay sort of outside of what was going on, but knowing, of course, what they were doing to their bodies at the same time.
Yeah, you know, it's at first that you just can't believe what you're seeing. I mean, it's so filthy, and you're going, this just doesn't make sense. How can they even be alive? Because none of the injections are sanitary that they're doing, and
they're sharing needles.
Well, they're actually now, they have an understanding of HIV, and they've reduced the amount of needles that they share. But what they share is the cookers. Basically, with heroin, you have to heat it up to be able to liquefy it and draw it up into your syringe. So the cookers are absolutely filthy. They use a little cotton to filter out the particles. That cotton is sometimes a piece of cigarette filter that someone's picked up off the ground and scrunched in their filthy fingers and dropped in the cooker. So you're wondering why every single injection doesn't lead at least to an abscess. And they do get terrible abscesses. So
in fact, you have a photo of one of these guys with a really scary-looking abscess on his arm.
You know, and that was a bad period of time in San Francisco. The county hospital in San Francisco was mistreating abscesses at that time. They were doing this deep carve that you see the pictures of in the book. And that's completely unnecessary. The standard of care now is just a minor incision and drain, and it causes very little scarring. It's cheap to do. It doesn't require an overnight stay in the hospital, and it doesn't scare the addicts away from the hospital. So luckily, we discussed with the surgeons this process. It just didn't make sense to us, because these guys had these horrible gashes, and then the doctors wouldn't give them painkillers, right? Because they're opiate addicts, so they don't want to give them painkillers. And as a result, they'd be let out of the hospital with humongous gashes, just wincing in pain. And of course, they'd have to just, you know, run out, buy as much heroin as they could to try to stave away the pain.
And we're almost up in a break here, but how much of their condition do you think was drug-related, and how much just sort of the ill health that comes from using drugs?
Well, you know, heroin doesn't destroy your organs. Unlike crack cocaine and methamphetamine, it doesn't physically damage you. What damages you is taking it in a filthy way. And so that's why you have these old heroin addicts, right? They're able to survive. Alcohol is worse on your organs. But the problem with heroin is the physical addiction, and then the fact that because of the way we repress it, they run into these filthy spaces and inject it on the run under filthy conditions, and then they get HIV, hepatitis C, and abscesses and fall apart.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Philippe Bourgois. He's an anthropologist at the University of Pennsylvania and joins us today on Radio Times to talk about his book. It's called Righteous Dope Fiend, and it's based on the 12 years that he spent in a homeless community in San Francisco, living with and trying to understand heroin and crack cocaine addicts. And we're taking calls here on Radio Times at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener offers 11 areas of real-world graduate studies taught by experts in their fields. Their convenient campus location and schedules accommodate working professionals. Details at widener.edu.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 10:20. Ahead in the second hour at 11, Fresh Air's TV and culture critic David Bianculli discusses his new book about the Smothers Brothers called Dangerously Funny. This afternoon's forecast, a high of 48 degrees under partly cloudy skies. Overcast overnight, low falling back to 41. Tomorrow, a chance of sprinkles, otherwise cloudy. Tuesday's high 54 degrees. Plenty of sunshine Wednesday, but colder, high only reaching 38.
Would you believe Hanukkah songs by Woody Guthrie? Yep, that's right. Recently discovered holiday lyrics by America's legendary balladeer and music by the Klezmatics. Celebrate Hanukkah with Woody Guthrie, the Klezmatics, and me, Murray Horwitz. It's a happy, joyous Hanukkah from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Clear Mobile Internet supports WHYY. Clear's 4G WiMAX network covering Philadelphia is designed to allow users to stream TV, movies, or public radio all over town. Clear, now covering Philadelphia. Details at clear.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. University of Pennsylvania anthropologist Philippe Bourgois spent 12 years studying, learning from, and occasionally living with a community of homeless heroin addicts and crack cocaine smokers in San Francisco. There's a book and also two exhibitions here in Philadelphia called Righteous Dope Fiend, about this world that very few people know about or have spent time with. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, trying to understand this world of dope fiends, as they call themselves, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talk a bit, if you could, about how race figures into these communities as well.
Yeah, in the first stage of my field work, the encampment was all white. And then about a year into it, an African-American man who had grown up with one of the white guys in the same neighborhood came in, and he had a job at that point, so he had money, so he was welcome because he was contributing more than other people to the heroin that was being used. And then all of a sudden, I started seeing extraordinary racial tensions erupting, because the homeless are just as racist, if not more racist, than the larger society, and they don't mince words. They're competing for the same spaces, and the African Americans would make fun of the whites for being, as they would call them, stanky white dope fiends who lacked initiative, and the whites would use racist epithets against the African Americans. It was, and all of a sudden there was a white flight phenomenon, just like in the suburbs, where
moving out of the encampment.
So the all white encampment started to get integrated, and then boom, they all fled, and it became an all black encampment. It was really amazing, and so the white encampment was just a half a block down, and then they were quarreling and fighting and stealing from each other. And then that started, after some time, that stabilized again. Occasionally you would see white and African-American running partners, that's friendships developing. But for the most part, it was really very antagonistic.
You also describe their relationship with their families, and I don't want to make too much of a deal of it, but it seemed as if the white homeless drug addicts didn't have much of a relationship with their families, whereas for the blacks, there was more connection, the more back and forth.
Yeah, it's a very interesting distinction. You see that the African-American family is quite different from the white family in dealing with the problem of addiction. So the whites had essentially been thrown out and had lost contact with their family, and had lost contact with their children, whereas the African-Americans would often, not all of them, but many of them, would go home for family reunions, mm-hmm. would go home for Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, and so forth. And there were often children would visit their fathers and try to get them into treatment, try to integrate them back into the family. They wouldn't give up on them. It was a painful thing to see, because you could see that these guys had just completely failed their families and were just repeatedly, ongoingly failing their families. They would try. They would go visit them. They would have good intentions, and boom, they just couldn't hold out for more than 24 hours, and then they'd fall right back into drugs and come back and have broken everyone's heart in their family again.
Were there common factors that you saw from the families where these guys came from?
There were a few patterns. Some were from very violent and very abusive families. Actually, many of them were from very violent and very abusive families where there was alcoholism and in some cases even already heroin use in the family. But others were from stable working class families. Mm-hmm. All were from poor families in this setting. And they were from families often that had become destabilized. In other words, they had been hit by deindustrialization, something that's affected Philadelphia terribly since World War II. Their fathers had worked at unionized jobs in stable factories and so forth that just from one day to the next just went up and left, went overseas. And so all of a sudden the family would be thrown in disarray, and that would often break up the family and cause all kinds of dislocations as these kids were just coming of age. So they came of age during that period in the late 70s 1930s, when there just weren't those working class jobs anymore. You could no longer find the stable unionized job the way you could, you know, right after World War II, when often their parents had immigrated from the countryside. So they weren't that prepared to even deal with the city. You see that very clearly. It's a hard thing to move from the countryside to the city. And they came from poor backgrounds. They were ill prepared. They found jobs at first, lost those jobs, and their families suffered. But in some cases, they were just the black sheep. They were the only one who had gone down the road to addiction. And in other cases, the entire family was addicted to drugs.
I want to play another piece of a conversation, and this is between a 40-year-old addict and his 70-year-old father. They're actually on the steps of the father's house. And I wonder, Philippe, if you could again set this up for our listeners.
Yeah, this was a very moving moment. We have a long section on this in our book where we give you the whole conversation. We actually filmed it. In this case, Frank was...
And that's the son.
Yeah, that's the son. He's 40 years old at this point. He invited us to visit his father. We had been interviewing him about his relationship to his father, and he really loved his father. And you see in it the pain that addiction causes to families. The father was just baffled. He didn't know how to deal with his son. He was angry at his son. He felt guilty about his son. And the son still wanted, you know, at age 40, still wanted to please his father, was begging for understanding about his addiction. And you hear that just in this short excerpt.
Let's listen.
It's inconceivable to me that you can't think you're going to get hooked on something that
you're
doing.
Wait, you think somebody's going to do that deliberately, thinking they're going to get hooked on it? I had no idea. I thought I could stop anytime I wanted to.
Okay.
I had absolutely no idea that I was ever going to get hooked on drugs. None whatsoever.
You know? Well, that's fine, but I mean. We just go around in circles on this. So what difference does it make? You got hooked on me, and you basically committed suicide. Basically, that's what you've done. You've been dying for 20 years.
Very powerful. And that's the father saying, basically what you've done, you've been committing suicide, you've been dying for 20 years. A father saying that to his son.
Yeah, and you hear him grasping for words. You feel the pain of the father and the son begging for understanding about his addiction, and you just see the tragedy of that.
And that's part of a longer conversation. And I mean, I don't want to be too clinical here, but what you also hear from the son, Frank, is just the level of denial, it seems, just sort of denying, as the father says, well, of course you would. I mean, if you use drugs, you're going to get hooked on this stuff. And the son saying, if I had known, I never would have taken up the drugs.
You see, you have to remember, this guy was the generation of the late 60s, early 70s. And we completely forget about this. But back then, heroin was thought of as cool, believe it or not. You know, there just wasn't the same level of awareness. And so he was just being trying to be a cool, hip, high school student type thing. So he got addicted very young. And, and at first, when you're smart and you're able to do things, you think it's going to go okay. And the next thing you know, you're swept off your feet and you can't maintain it.
You also include a quote from a guy named Hank. And let me just read this. And he says, you know how when you're walking and you look across the street and you see someone you think you know, and then you walk closer and it turns out to be an old friend, someone you used to kick it with as a kid, and you walk up to each other and you ask how the other's doing, and you talk for a while, and then you leave saying to yourself, wow, it was really good to see him. And then he says, that's what heroin feels like to me. Whew.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It takes your breath away.
Yeah,
it really does.
It's such a powerful addiction, and it's so seductive. And the tragedy is you have people that are very nice. You know, Hank was a beautiful person. He was full of love. You can hear it in what he would pick to describe his addiction. And, you know, he's condemned to living on the side of the road and running away from the police. And he had worked as a welder, and we visited his old employer. It was a shutdown shop that now dealt with Taiwan. That's where all the, if that hadn't happened to him, if there hadn't been that terrible industrial restructuring in the United States, he might have been able to hold on and wouldn't have fallen into homelessness and into such destructive substance abuse.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And Philippe Bourgois is our guest today on Radio Times. He's an anthropologist, and we're talking about the 12 years he spent living with and learning from a community of homeless heroin addicts and crack smokers Hours in San Francisco. It's a subject of his book, which he has co-authored with Jeff Schonberg, called Righteous Dope Fiend, helping us understand the world of drug addiction, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We've been focusing largely on the men in this community, but there is this, I would say, pretty extraordinary woman named, or you call Tina, yeah, in this book. Describe for our listeners Tina as you first meet her.
Well, Tina was very charismatic. She was, when we first met her, she was smoking crack. She wasn't a heroin user. And she really carved out a space for herself. She refused to succumb to the violence that exists on the street against women. She was very tough. When guys came up onto her inappropriately, in one case she smashed her radio over the head of one guy, and he never bothered her again. Mm-hmm. And then she fell madly in love with one of the other central characters in our book, Carter. And Carter was a heroin addict. And there, I mean, basically you could describe them as a cross between Romeo and Juliet and Bonnie and Clyde. They were just madly in love with each other. Their eyes would light up when they'd see each other. And tragically, their love was so strong that they each switched to one another's drug of choice. So they got the worst of both worlds. They both became heroin addicts and chronic crack smokers. And then they set up what we call a domestic outlaw encampment. Tina had tremendous scavenging skills. She on garbage day, she would rove the city and collect all kinds of fancy clothes. She dressed to the nines. She was always perfectly dressed, and never had trouble, sifting through clothes at the Goodwill and so forth, and locating the latest styles. And Carter would, for example, he found a Victorian love seat that someone had thrown out, and they put that in the center of their encampment, and they would just basically hug each other and clink their crack pipes as if it was champagne. And then, of course, they would betray each other, because that's the nature of drugs and poverty in these kinds of conditions. They would start cheating on who was using more of whose drugs, and it would break up into violence and antagonism. So it was a tragic thing to see, because you saw how much love they had for each other, and then just how dysfunctional that relationship became. But the good news is, Tina made it out.
Wow.
She made it into, after several failures in treatment, she's now drug free. As they say on the street, she's fat. That's the best compliment.
Meaning literally,
yeah,
she's fat.
Yeah.
She's no longer.
Yeah, because she was emaciated with her crack use and heroin use. And the proof now that she's off of drugs is she's plump. She's heavy. And she did it through an evangelical church. She was very religious, and that's given her stability.
And again, to understand this romantic relationship and the role of drugs, you describe Tina and Carter, that he would inject her, that was sort of a sign of a romantic sign, that he was the injector and she was the injectee, I guess.
Yeah, it was a sad thing to see, because she basically, in as she says, she was pursuing her man, trying to get closer to him, and so she sort of gave up her body to him symbolically, and having him poke needles into her. And the next thing she knew, she was physically addicted to heroin, and then she realized, my gosh, what have I done? We're both now just dope fiends.
And cheating was called half-stepping.
Right. Right.
How did that work?
Well, basically, they were very jealous of one another's drug use, because when you're running partners together, when you're lovers and when you're combining all your resources, you're each supposed to use the same amounts of heroin. You're supposed to share everything, all your food, all your money, and all your drugs. So you're always a little bit suspicious that the other person has gone around the corner and, injected a little on their own, or smoked a little crack on their own, or kept a little bit of money on the side. And so it's a strange thing, and it's hard to understand at first, because you see a tremendous amount of solidarity, right. You see a tremendous amount of sharing, but it's on this tightrope of betrayal, of constant petty betrayal. So one hand will be giving a partner something, while the other hand pulls something out of their back pocket.
And just to move ahead with the story, Carter actually for a while was clean, but he did
die. He got
clean
first, actually. He made it through a treatment program, because he had been in the Army and qualified for a good VA program. And he got a job. He was clean for a year and a half. We had great hopes. We thought he was on his way to a whole new life. We have a whole chapter on this. And he was convinced he was going to make it. And he had made it. The problem is that you often relapse. And they say that with recovery, it often takes a half a dozen or a dozen relapses before you finally make it. And in his case, it was his birthday. He'd gotten a paycheck, and boom, he went on a binge. And he did the amount of heroin that he used to do, and that will kill you. I mean, heroin is a very deadly drug. Unless you have a very high physical tolerance due to your addiction, it just wipes you out practically. I mean, it stops your heart.
And just to make it even more poignant, at his funeral, he gets a presidential memorial certificate because he had been in the military. He was a veteran.
And that was the frustration that we felt, is why is it that only after someone dies is there money and resources and celebration spent on him by society. Basically, he should have been intervened. I mean, this guy had a lot of potential. He was very smart, and he was a very hard worker for that year and a half that he was clean. He was driving a truck, and he was thrilled. He was proud of it. He had made back up with his family. He was visiting his children. I mean, he was becoming a useful man again. And had there been a set of more coherent resources available to him, first of all, at a younger age, so that he wouldn't have had to spend 40 years doing this, but even later, because he responded well.
How did you navigate and negotiate the fact that you had money, you had things, they wanted money, they probably needed things as well? How did you figure out what that relationship was about between you and them?
It was very confusing. Basically, they would hit me up at first quite aggressively because they're addicts. They want money for their addiction. Their priority as righteous dope fiends is to manipulate everyone around them to get money for what they need most in life, which is putting heroin into their bloodstream. So I had to be tough and say no. But at the same time, I was realizing that they were generous to each other. So I had to learn when to participate in that, what we call moral economy of reciprocal exchange that they were involved in. And so, I would give them rides to the hospital. I would give them rides to the welfare office to try to get them hooked up with services. We would take them to the laundromat and pay for their laundry and so forth. And they appreciated that. They also liked, frankly, being around a professor. They liked talking with me. They liked having someone be interested in their life story. And because I'm convinced that they tell us a great deal about America. I think we learn a lot about a society by how it treats its most vulnerable population. And they really rose to that challenge, and they didn't sanitize anything. They showed me how bad they were, what a failure they were, also what their dreams were.
And did people think that you were part of this homeless encampment?
Yeah, you know,
we're almost up in a break, but yeah.
Yeah, no, of course, it was very embarrassing. I mean, I fit the profile. I'm a 40-something-year-old white male, and a lot of them were 40-something-year-old white males from that generation of the 70s. And I happen to be thin, so it makes me look, even more like a drug user. And that was actually something that stopped me at first from the work. I'd be embarrassed. My son at the time was 8 years old, and his friends would be coming home to our neighborhood, and they would see me hanging out with the homeless, and everyone knew they were dope fiends, and they'd say, "Oh my gosh, Emiliano's father he's fallen apart." And I'd have to reassure everyone, "No. I'm a professor. I'm doing this as research."
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with anthropologist Philippe Bourgois about his book. It's called Righteous Dope Fiend. It's about drug addicts, a homeless community in San Francisco that he got to know. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and announces its new Institute for Personalized Medicine, where individualized cancer therapy is defined by the unique genetic features of tumors. Decades of research have shown that no two cancers are alike and no two patients are alike. At Fox Chase, they are dedicated to pioneering the future of cancer therapy one patient at a time. Fox Chase, perfecting the science of compassionate cancer care. More at foxchase.org.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. In the second hour at 11, TV and culture critic David Bianculli talks about his new book entitled Dangerously Funny, the uncensored story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. This afternoon's forecast, partly cloudy skies, high 48 degrees. Cloudy overnight, low falling back to 41. Tomorrow, a chance of sprinkles, otherwise overcast, Tuesday's high 54 degrees. This is WHYY.
Mental health care is moving towards a recovery-based model, helping those with mental illness lead the best life possible. Many are concerned that an emphasis on care takes us away from the ultimate goal of cure. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll discuss recovery-based mental health care, how consumers view it, and how communities approach it. That's today at noon here on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with University of Pennsylvania anthropologist Philippe Bourgois about the 12 years he spent studying and learning from and often living with a community of homeless heroin addicts and crack smokers in San Francisco, the subject of his book called Righteous Dope Fiend, also two exhibitions here in Philadelphia, one at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, and the other at the Slott Foundation, both in West Philadelphia, and there are photographs there and more of what we're talking about today on Radio Times. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Lex from West Chester to join our conversation. Hi, Lex. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to thank you very much for talking about the subject of heroin addiction. I'm a recovering heroin addict. I just wanted to thank the anthropologist for helping to destigmatize this disease. And my question today was, did you find in San Francisco the predominant form of heroin to be tar heroin? In New York City, where I did my thing, it was the predominant form was China White heroin. Just wanted to know if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Lex, before you go, I just want to know, how long have you been clean?
I've been clean for 8.5 years
wow,
now.
Wow, fantastic.
Good for you.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
And it did take a number of tries in order to get clean?
You know what? I'm on my first try right now, but I did like 2 years of treatment, and that was probably the thing that... That's why I'm still sober. I'm still treating it to this day, like every day.
And what kind of a program was that that works?
It's a 12-step program. Mm-hmm. I continue to do to this day.
Great.
But I lived in a halfway house for about a year and a half, and I needed to do all that because I had to relearn everything.
Absolutely.
I had to learn how to live again.
Yeah, you know, well, we talk about that in the book. We have a whole chapter on treatment. And it's it's getting detoxed. The doctors can do that now. They can do it relatively painlessly with you know proper drugs to detox someone. But it's then that next period of getting reintegrated into society and finding something to do with your life that's so complicated.
And learning how to live.
Yeah,
as Lex
exactly.
Says.
And rebuilding relationships, finding a job, finding meaning in life. But what you asked is you're absolutely right. Basically, west of the Mississippi River in the United States, all the heroin is what's called Mexican black tar. It's basically a organized crime controlled division of the country, and everything east of the Mississippi River is either China White or now from Colombia. It's also a white powder as well, and we have very little understanding of why that is. But basically, organized crime is divided up the country. The black tar is particularly hard on your veins. I don't know what the technical term is, but basically it burns out your veins much faster. So people get more abscesses and they tend to lose their veins. Their veins get scarred very rapidly and they end up having to what they say muscle or skin pop, and that causes even more abscesses. So in some sense, addicts are in worse shape in California because they're basically very susceptible to abscesses just because of the accident of how the heroin is processed. It's just a chemical processing.
Lex, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And did you, when you watched them scoring drugs, I mean, did you see in the sort of hierarchy of drug dealing, how far up the hierarchy do you think you got?
No. These guys were at the very, very bottom. Sometimes they would start selling drugs, but never for very long because they'd start using too much of what they sold, and then they'd all of a sudden owe money to the guy that that was fronting. That's the term. They would be given 10 bags of heroin. For every 10 that they would sell, they'd be allowed to keep one. And the next thing you know, they'd have done two, and then they'd owe the seller two. But basically, drug dealing at that low level is very, very unstable. The police are constantly arresting people. But it's sort of like sweeping sunshine off of the street. As soon as someone's arrested, then, you know, there's someone else who's desperate, who's addicted, who's, you know, ready to sell. And so it's just a revolving door of people going in and out of jail. And you never, at the street level, you never see up the food chain. And if you go too high, you don't live to tell about it.
Indeed. let me get Hari from Havertown to join our conversation. Hari, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering to what extent the ones who made it, you know, who got out of that community, how were they treated? I mean, did people speak of them like with jealousy, like they wanted to be like them, or, you know, did they kind of ignore them and pretend they were never there? I was wondering if you could.
You know,
comment.
It's an interesting
Thanks,
question
Holly.
Because it gets at that sense of community that we discovered among the homeless, and basically, there was an ambiguous feeling. There was a feeling of pride and hope that they too could do it some way, just like the other person had made it. But there was also a feeling of missing the person, because really, the only way to stay clean is to stay away from your former friends who are users, from your former acquaintances. So basically, whenever someone got clean, they would lose that person to their social network, and they would have to, you know, stay losing that person, because as soon as you saw the person starting to revisit, it usually was just a question of time before they'd fall into using drugs again. And that's exactly what happened with Carter. And in a sense, when someone would start visiting, it was a sad thing to see. They wouldn't protect that person. They would immediately offer to share drugs, because you could see they were trying to reintegrate them, in a sense, into their community, even though they would state ostensibly that they were proud that that person had a job, was doing good, was looking healthy, and so forth. In fact, they wanted to reintegrate them into their lives.
That said, what do you think, in terms of either programs or policies, would help these long-term homeless drug addicts?
You know, we saw there are a lot of programs that work, and there's a lot being developed across internationally as well that we've seen that's worked. For this demographic, for these older addicts who've been on the streets for, you know, over 20 years, some of them 30, 40 years, there's basically Switzerland has discovered an extraordinary solution to this problem. And basically, people that have failed treatment repeatedly and have tried methadone and it hasn't worked for them, have tried abstinence and it hasn't worked for them, have been in and out of jail all their lives, basically what they do is they prescribe heroin to them.
Wow.
And the condition is that the person stabilize, that the person get their life together, that the person stop committing crime, stop beating up everyone around them, stop stealing, and start, you know, forging a life for themselves. And it works sort of like magic. I mean, if you stop and think about it. And
because I guess they move out of the idea.
Yeah, they're no longer outlaws, right?
Eventually.
Now they're patients. Their addiction is being treated. They're being given what they think they want, which is heroin. Often, what's really ironic is what the Swiss are finding is that these guys who have failed dozens of methadone programs, who are now being given heroin, more of them actually go into full abstinence after a year, 2 years of being prescribed heroin than those who are in the methadone treatment programs. Hmm. Because all of a sudden, when your craving is dealt with, you start having to think about the rest of your life. What is it that makes me so obsessed about taking this drug every day and nodding out and drooling and basically wasting my time? I mean,
sounds so counterintuitive.
Yeah, it
is.
It is. But, you know, when you think about it, addiction, heroin addiction, really organizes your life, especially if you've had a somewhat traumatic life, a life of with lots of pain, with a family that's been difficult, or with, you know, unemployment, with frustrations at school, with negative experiences with institutions. When you're addicted, as soon as you wake up in the morning, you know exactly what you need to do. You need to get heroin in your body. You don't need to worry about apologizing to family who you've betrayed. You don't need to worry about finding a job. You don't need to worry about, you know, your mental illness, anything. You need to worry about getting heroin. So basically, it organizes your life when you're a disorganized person. So that's, you know, for a certain profile of street-based user. And then when all of a sudden all that is satisfied, you can start thinking what your deeper problems are and start addressing that.
When you pass a homeless person, either Philadelphia or any other city that you're in, Do you wrestle with yourself about what to do and whether to give them money or how to acknowledge them? Because I think anyone that lives in a city, this happens, and it's often not clear what the right thing to do is.
Of course, because we live you know, amongst one another, and you know, how can we just walk by this person that's so visibly in pain and so visibly confused? What I do, actually, generally, is I give a quarter. I tell them, you know, here's a quarter, sorry I can't give you more. And it creates at least a moment of recognition, and they often thank me for it, and, you know, and I tell them good luck and so forth. And it you know, it creates a communication. It creates a sense of shared humanity.
And a quarter is what? Not enough to...
Well, it's not enough for anything except to express some kind of human solidarity on some level. It's not enough for them to use it to hurt themselves with. It is enough to, you know, go for buying a sandwich. I mean, when you give a homeless person money, they spend some of it on food and some of it on drugs and some of it on socks and mm-hmm. things like that. So they need the money. And also, you know, when they're in physical pain with addiction, they need the opiates. In that sense, you know, what the guy said, what Felix said on the excerpt that you chose, you know, they understand it as medication because their bodies can't function. They're in physical, you know, distress without it.
Let me get Beth from, looks like Chester County to join our conversation. Beth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm the mother of a recovered heroin addict. He's been clean for 3.5 years.
Oh, great.
Good for him.
I want to comment on about what to do when I see a homeless addict. I don't give them money, ever. But I will give them my gloves. Hmm. I'll give them, you know, run someplace and get food. Our son was without a home for a while because we said we either have to get with our program or... get in recovery. The recovery process is long and expensive. We spent close to $400,000 on halfway houses, on rehabilitative programs, and we kept going, and fortunately we had the resources to do that.
Well, congratulations.
And he's doing better.
And we kept him away from our home for 2 years. He did not see our home for 2 years. We brought all of our holidays and celebrations to him in his halfway house. And what saddens me is that the playing field is not leveled, that our son has an excellent, excellent chance of outcome because he has this tremendous toolbox that's been honed over the past 3.5 years. And poor families and families that have dysfunction don't have access to those things. And that is the great sadness for me. As joyful as I am about my son's recovery, I am so, so sad that these tools are not available to everyone.
That's a very moving thing for you to say, Beth, and I think gets to, in certain ways, Philippe Bergois, the heart of what your work has been about.
Exactly. We need to restructure how we spend our resources in our society. And instead of locking people up in prison where they're often brutalized, where they're throwing up all over themselves in cells, getting even more violent, getting even more trained in becoming criminals. And it's very expensive to lock people up. We should be investing in treatment, in the kinds of resources that can deal with the complicated process of destructive drug consumption. And there are programs that work. They exist around the world. They exist here in Philadelphia.
In fact, you've been in Philadelphia for a couple of years now, beginning to do a similar, I guess, investigation of drug addiction and homelessness in this city. A quick snapshot of what you found?
Yeah, Philadelphia, you know, is actually the poorest of all the large cities in the United States and has some of the largest proportions of substance abuse. It's a city that's really in crisis with respect to exactly what I study. It's also a city with great programs. Philadelphia has more recovery houses than any other city. North Philadelphia, especially the Kensington area, and it's a very important phenomenon. It's often recovered addicts themselves who've set up these self-help houses, and they can benefit from certain minimal city resources. And it does us a great service because it keeps people off the street, it keeps people from committing crime, and it gets people into that very complicated process of rebuilding themselves once they've, you know, quit the acute phase of the addiction, and then they have to find a new meaning in life.
And as you say, real estate is very expensive in San Francisco and Philadelphia by comparison. Relatively cheap, right?
Yeah, we're one of the cheapest places for rent. We actually have more abandoned properties in Philadelphia than Detroit on a per building ratio. And so what's important is that the city begin rehabilitating those houses and set them up for recovery, set them up for the homeless, set them up for people that need a space to get their lives together, rather than wasting money throwing people in jail, which we've seen just hasn't been working. We've been throwing more and more and more people in jail, and drugs have just gotten cheaper and purer than they ever were before. It's really a terrible irony.
And this community, this place in San Francisco where these people live, does that exist, or what is there now when you began, what, 15 years ago?
Yeah, probably? You know, believe it or not, it's still there. I've always wondered how a city that has so much gentrification and so much wealth can maintain these little sort of pools of just decay. But it's the former industrial district, so it's sort of in a swampy area, and it has a lot of, you know, sort of huge decrepit warehouses. Some of them have been gentrified with organic, you know, distribution of vegetables and stuff like that going on. But about half of them are still just abandoned.
Wow.
And so it provides this kind of safe space for accommodating the very poor. And you know, for tolerating a certain amount of out of the norm deviance.
And we're almost out of time here. And we talked about Tina and some of the other homeless people that you knew. Have you been able to stay in touch with them, or do they just disperse? And
we have. There's one guy who actually has a telephone. He's been stabilized through. Through methadone, and he's gotten on SSI, and he's an older guy, and he has a history of working in the labor force, and he had basically broken his back moving. Can you believe it? Carrying pianos on one of those day labor jobs, and he didn't break his back, but he strained it beyond repair and cracked the vertebrae. So he qualified for SSI, and that stabilized him. He lives in someone's garage, basically a benefactor's garage, a guy who used to come by and give them a dollar occasionally, and then he had formed a relationship, started trusting him, and now the guy lets him live in his garage. He pays rent through his SSI.
I thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Philippe Bourgois been our guest, and his book is called Righteous Dope Fiend. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Leave us an email. You can also find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member-supported NPR station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.